You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, I'm talking to the directors of two new films which take the starting point and continuing theme of a figure walking through a landscape, and then twist it in unexpected directions. Later in the show, I'm going to be talking to Christine Malloy, one half of the filmmaking duo Desperate Optimists, about their new film Helen, which concerns a young woman who takes part in a police reconstruction of a girl going missing and starts to take over her life, from dating her boyfriend to getting maths advice from her parents. First, though, I'm talking to Bent Hemmer, the director of a gentle new Norwegian comedy called O Horten, which depicts the tale of a recently retired train driver who gets embroiled in a series of misadventures of the kind Victor Meldrew would be proud of. From losing his shoes in a locker room and only finding red stilettos to replace them, to ending up in a car driven by a blind man.
I watched your film O Horten last night and really enjoyed it. Since you've made films both in Norwegian and in English, I was wondering, with this film, because the dialogue perhaps doesn't seem to be as important as the plot and the mise-en-scène, whether you're intending this more for an international audience who could just sort of enjoy the antics of the lead character without having to concentrate too heavily on the machinations of the script.
But very often I have little dialogue in my films, and I used to it's a little joke, but still it's very hard to write good dialogue. So as less I can write, it's better. Very often I also find situations that I start with the situation. Oh, Horten is a little different. It's pieced together. I mean, some of the other films, or most of the other films, are kind of, I start with a situation or in the center and work my way out. On this one, I try to find the center, and I don't know if I found it. I feel like I'm still traveling with Odd Horten in a way. So the process was different this time. But yeah, you might be right that it might be easier to travel with the films without too much dialogue in a unknown language, maybe. But I don't plan it that way. I mean, that's not why I do it. I mean, I think I feel like telling it without too much dialogue. I like to show it more than say it.
Sure. Well, it's interesting because stand-up comedy is also described as observational humor, and certainly the plot of this film seems very much like it's taken from life, that you've observed situations of people around you and then cherry-pick them for the best moments that perhaps would work in a film and tell a story of this hapless individual.
I used to say I'm stealing 360 degrees all the time. And maybe also to feel that, I mean, but you can do that with any film. I mean, maybe it's closer to a kind of documentary way of shooting. But I mean, you have to do that even if you do sci-fi or whatever. You have to lead your audience into your universe and believe in it, even if it's pure fantasy. But this is, maybe it looks more like the life itself than other films. But I think I would try to work just as hard on that part, whatever kind of genre I would work in. It's crucial.
What would you say were the was the inspiration for making this film in the first place?
I don't know really. How it came to me. Like I said, I pieced it together, and I found some old notes after I finished the film, and I saw that I had been sketching on a train conductor, but I forgot it. And to forget is also a good tool, I think, in the process of finding out what to tell the story about, because if it's important, it comes back to you in one or the other way. So what came first and how I put it together, I'm really not sure. The ski jumping was also a scene that I, not a scene, but an idea I had for a long time, but couldn't really find a way to use it. So it was really a piecing together project, this one, I must say.
Mm. This is the second film you've made, following Kitchen Stories, that's about older men and how they're trying to find their place in the world. What would you say was your interest in the older generation? Is it because you're approaching middle age and you're thinking about how perhaps life progresses, or is it just because they're interesting characters that maybe aren't served well enough by film in general?
Yeah, all of it, I think. When I made my first film, Eggs, then it was, I mean, easier for me to say that I really wanted to make a film about old people. And I also related the story a lot to my grandparents, which I spent a lot of time together with and was very fond of. Now I've done it several times, and now I like to say also that when you make a film about middle-aged people, you never ask that question, you know. So obviously it's not too many films about old people, and I also find it interesting, I mean, the story in the film, but also to work with the old people, with lived life, not only the story in the film, but with old actors. And yeah, so it still challenges, and I also hope that it represents things in life for people in other ages and other stages of life that you can recognize and maybe transfer to.
Mm.
At least that's what I'm trying to.
Well, I think my favorite scene in the movie actually is when O. Horton breaks into the apartment and comes across the little boy. And the sort of the dynamic between them, I'd have been quite happy to watch another half an hour of, you know, their sort of misadventures together.
I'm still living with that because it's my son, and I really have to bribe him a lot with the PlayStation and money, and even I think the weight on the scale was that he demanded that I had to serve him choco balls for breakfast to see him the day after. And now he tried to renegotiate the whole deal with me. So, no, that was really nice scene. I was also very afraid of that scene, I must say, because, well, first of all, it's an important scene. It's a, let's say, point of no return in a way, when things starting to go the other way for Odd Horton. And I was concerned if would Odd Horton do a thing like that, go into another apartment. But I think it's on the edge, but I was nervous about that. But I like it a lot now, so I'm happy I did it. I was very close to not to shoot it, actually. But it was nice to shoot, and I think it also is a very... I like the poetry in the scene also, with the young boy, which is a part of Odd Horton also, but it's very hard for him to discover that young boy in himself.
Mm.
So we have him as an old man and the young boy with life in front of him. So it's the young boy can really turn his life upside down, which he really needs. So,
well, I suppose it's as much that now that he's retired, the liberation that he has with life isn't that dissimilar to being a young boy again.
Yeah, and to be free is also hard. I mean, like the Germans after the First World War, and when suddenly you are free, and that makes people very afraid. Also, I mean, we have seen it in the history. You have seen books about that. And I think on a personal level, it's the same. You are scared to death by getting this freedom. What is freedom? Freedom from what? To what? So absolutely, it's the whole scene represents a lot. It does.
Mm.
And it's for him, it's good to be told to sit there. If not, he would not be able to get further on with his life, maybe. I mean, it's not his decision in a way.
Mm.
The young boy. But it's also the boy in him, maybe, that makes him do it.
Mm. Well, it was interesting that you used the word poetry to describe the way some of the scenes play out, because you use long takes without cutting, And that does add a certain kind of anticipation and also visual poetry to what's going on. Is that something that you find is very important with directing, to kind of let the scene breathe so that audiences can almost relax into what's going on without being sort of spoon-fed the plot?
Yeah, I do that. But I also have to say that different type of films requires different pace and different way of being shot. So, I couldn't do it that way if I shot an action film. So, you have to find the language that fits to the story you want to tell and into the atmosphere you want to catch. Because to catch an atmosphere is really the trick. You can have all kind of elements in the film, right? But it's stone dead, no atmosphere there. You never know if you are catching it. And I think the pace and the way you shoot it is at least one of the main variables to catch the atmosphere. And I think this way of shooting these kind of films and my view on these characters fits quite good.
Mm. Well, and another character in the film actually almost seems to be the landscapes and the interiors that you set it in, which to a certain extent seem to be as important as the people that you've written for the story.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And it's, Horten is a lot of night shots. And I didn't plan to shoot during night. I mean, it's very expensive. It requires a lot of light. But on the other hand, I did it also to emphasize the solitude in the film, that there are not too many people around him. But on the other hand, I mean, he was into the airport with a lot of people, but he's still very lonely. So, and you know that from big cities, you can absolutely show loneliness among a lot of people also. But I think I use, yes, probably I used the landscape and environment to build up this feeling, which again leads to the part of the atmosphere, I think.
Mm.
And it's also about, if you're talking about Nordic storytellers, this even, I mean, we are not all like Odd Horten up in the Nordic countries. I mean, we are more like the people you meet every day here in London, and people are social human beings. But still, when it comes to art, it's easy for us, I think, to tell stories through this kind of environment and through loneliness, and because it has a deep tradition, and I think also it has to do with that we are very few people. A lot of the time is cold. We have to be inside, and it's a lot of space for a few people. So it's probably very deep in us.
Mm. Well, and also at the same time, while it's very beautiful, the landscape that you shoot it in, both the city and when he's on the train, it's also quite a dangerous environment if you're elderly, because you show people falling over and Horten having to help the guy who's fallen over a couple of times outside the tobacco shop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to mention, you know, the danger of wandering around an airport without being arrested.
Yeah. Try to sell your boat at the airport is also something. I mean, it's alienation. I'm working with alienation also and using the environment to show that, this kind of labyrinth stuff.
Hmm. I mean, at the risk of comparing your own personal history too much to the people that you write for the screen, you were a literature student, which inevitably is somewhat a solo pursuit, that you bury yourself in books and have that engagement with the world of fiction, maybe rather than other people. And I was wondering if that's the sort of thing that led you to create these characters on film and also to, say, adapt the work of Bukowski in your earlier film.
Yes, I think I'm... Well, first of all, I think I'm quite wide in my references. I'm not only literature, but of course also film, but to compare those two, I think literature is the one that maybe has inspired me the most, if we are talking about art forms.
Mm.
From my very childhood, when my grandmother was reading for me, I really enjoyed that. I think that stimulated my own career. and way of seeing things in my own way.
Hmm. Having made most of your films in your native tongue, but also made one film for the American market, do you think perhaps that's a way that international cinema can engage with America more, rather than saying, we'll make a film and you remake it, you come over here and we sort of actually help you make the films in the first place?
I think it's, you don't have to go only that direction. I think it's interesting that the people from different countries are visiting other countries to see. It gives you a fresh view of things, to not control it. I mean, to have all the undertext all the time, all the context. It gives really a kind of another flavor, which is interesting. It can also be a disaster, of course. But I mean, the language itself is not that precise either. And you have, you are precise in another way. It's so easy to don't say anything when you work in your own language. You just take for granted that people know what you are up for. So it's a little, it's another approach in a way, but mainly it is the same. I mean, you talk the language and you listen, and you maybe more have to lean on the actors with the way the tone in the words and like that. But still, it's what you ask me for. I think it's interesting. I don't know if it will solve the any problems, and that's the only way to do it. But it's. I liked it, and it was fresh for me also, and hopefully it was fresh for American audience to see a film like that made by a foreigner.
Well, I wonder as well if it's something that Scandinavians do with greater ease than other Europeans, because looking at, say, some of Lars von Trier's films, like Mandalay and Dear Wendy, there's an engagement with American cinema, but on your terms rather than on theirs.
Yeah. I haven't seen his films, to be honest with you. But for me, I don't know. I would like to work more I've been reading scripts in both, from the US and from England. For me, what is it? I mean, the actors, first of all, English, British actors are so wonderful. That would be something to work more with. Finding a story, I mean, you don't do it geographically. It's something about the story that you are looking for, and see if you have the passion for it and think you can do something good. So it doesn't matter if it's what country is it. I mean, it could also, well, it's harder to do it in Russia, I believe. But still, that's interesting too.
Brilliant. Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Next, here's my interview with Christine Malloy about her new film, Helen.
This is your first feature-length story, because although you released a feature-length compilation of civic life, this is one narrative, obviously, you know, told over an hour and 10 minutes. When it came to you guys approaching a feature-length narrative, did you find that a bit of a struggle to write a much longer story, or had you already done longer stories like that on stage before?
Well, we've certainly worked with obviously longer structures that have to evolve over time in our theatre work, although our theatre work was very experimental and very much at the heart of our theatre work was an exploration of narrative structure. So you wouldn't have called our theatre work conventional in any way, either in its approach to narrative or performance. With Civic Life, we were lucky in that one of our Civic Life films, Daydream, which isn't part of the DVD compilation, it was made after we put the DVD together, which was commissioned by Liverpool and was a half-hour film. And in a way, it was more kind of purist in its approach to the civic life form. So it's made up of about, I think it's 9 or 10 scenes that are all very disparate, and they aren't really joined together in any way other than the fact that they exist one after the other. And going through the process of making Daydream, I think we learned a huge amount about trying to extend the methodology of the Civic Life Project over a longer time frame. I mean, we didn't make Daydream as a kind of a warm-up act to a feature. The feature then came out of a funding situation that arose in the end of 2006 and coming into 2007, when a number of funding agencies approached us at the same time looking for standalone Civic Life short films to commission. And, you know, we then saw that as an opportunity for us to explore the possibility of a Civic Life feature-length film. And, you know, our partners, the funding partners, luckily enough, were kind of seduced by the idea. So rather than us making four standalone shorts, we pooled the resources and the money together and made a feature-length film, which, of course, came with a lot of challenges because it was never going to be a film made in a conventional way. And because it's a Civic Life film, being funded in this very kind of unique way, we've sometimes called it lead in the saddle before we, you know, set out to make the film. Things that we had to address because the film was being made as a Civic Life film, part of the Civic Life series. Things that we had to address that filmmakers normally wouldn't have to consider or take into consideration in any way, shape, or form. That, you know, set up restrictions, but at the same time, you know, helped us to shape the film into the film that it is. So, you know, what were some of the difficulties that we encountered in making the film were also what helped to make it what it is.
And again, with this film, you used untrained actors from the local community. But of course, because it's a longer narrative, it meant when it came to casting Helen, you obviously needed someone who could carry a movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's fantastic. And what was the process of casting her like?
Well, you know, for the Civic Life films, we never cast. And casting for the part of Helen was our only exception.
Okay.
And the reason we decided we had to do it is very obvious for what you've just said. She carries the whole film. And it was really important to us that we didn't just say yes to the first young woman who came our way, that we actively went looking for somebody who we felt would inhabit the world and space of the film in the way that we hoped, wished, wanted somebody to inhabit that space. And we found Annie very late in the day. I can't say that our casting process was hugely successful in that we were looking for somebody during the summer of 2007. The summer months invariably are very difficult if you're looking for young people because schools are closed, colleges are closed. You know, groups, community groups or youth groups don't tend to meet in the summer. So we really did struggle, and we were looking in Dublin, we were looking in Birmingham, we were looking in Newcastle. And I suppose we met a lot of young women who maybe had aspirations and ambitions to perform or to act. And what we were looking for was to find not somebody who was, you know, driven by a desire to be an actress, but somebody who would be right for the film. And we eventually got Annie in at the beginning of October, and we started to shoot on the 20th of October. So, as I said, she kind of arrived very, very late in the day, and it was a last-ditch effort working with Culture 10 in Newcastle, who put us in touch with a local community group that deal with young women and use, like, community drama as a strategy to help young women deal with issues that are relevant to them. And Annie was a very recent member of this company called Open Class, and they sent six women an audition that we held. And basically for all the auditions, what we do is talk to the women and take their photographs. And so our interest is less can they act or have they ever acted. Much better for us if they haven't. And what we were really interested was just, you know, in the kind of qualities that Annie had in spades, which is a real kind of an assurance. She's kind of got a vulnerability, but she's also quite incredibly strong and She doesn't force anything. She more or less is the way she is. The way she behaves in our film is kind of the way she is anyway. Mm. She's a bit inscrutable. You think she's kind of shy and lacking in confidence, but actually she's a very confident young woman who's got a lot going on under the surface. And so our worry was that once she actually came to the shoot, that somehow she'd lose some of those qualities, but she didn't. And we then allowed her performance to dictate how the other performances were going to work in the film. We took Annie's presence and her performance as our cue to, you know, how we would work with everybody else. But yeah, no, I think we were lucky. You're always lucky, and particularly if you're not going after, you know, professional actors who've got a reputation and a body of work you can look at. Annie was an unknown element, and we felt very pleased that we found her the way we really hoped we'd find her, which is through, you know, the community sources in the locales where we were actually shooting the film.
Well, it's interesting as well because in the film she's thematically being compared against the missing girl Joy, but you never actually show any footage of Joy herself. So she occupies this space where she's both one person and the double of another, but because that other person never exists in filmic terms, she has this sort of double presence, which I think is something very interesting that you're playing with.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that sometimes I think that Helen doesn't really exist in the film either, because we really don't see her. We get a little taste of her early on, like when she comes into the police line, you know, the audition for the stand-in, and then when she's in the park before she puts on the yellow jacket. But for most of the film, we do see this kind of hybrid. We see Aunt Helen as the stand-in for Joy. So she's not quite herself, and she isn't Joy either. She's some kind of hybrid, you know. In a way, the film, I think both young women are absent in a way, both Joy and Helen. It's a film where absence is a very strong theme in the film. And instead, we have this odd assembly of this young woman's inhabiting of someone else's being without even really knowing who that person is. I suppose the moment we realised, because we began in developing the ideas for the film by focusing on the missing girl Joy, and the moment the idea of the stand-in kind of came into the frame, myself and Joe realised that this is something that we could really become excited by and would be very interested in. So you're always kind of hoping and looking for those moments that enter into the frame when you're developing a piece of work. And we were, you know, it all kind of made sense to us once we began to shift our attention away from Joy and onto the stand-in Helen.
So was the script something that still developed as you were starting to shoot the film itself?
you better believe it. Well, I think it's the very nature of the Civic Life Project, but the script comes in very late in the day, and it kind of has to, because first and foremost, it's very much a response to the environment. They're almost like, we call them community films. They're also slightly site-specific. And one of the givens with the film that we often can't do an awful lot about are the locations where we're going to be shooting, because we're pointed towards a lot of the locations by our funders. And as well as that, you know, working with the finding our performers through local community groups is also something that we would be very caught up in, and the dialogues that we would have with people are very much from the early part of the development, and the script comes in later on, and we deliberately keep it all very, very open. We kind of have to, because once we start to shoot, there's lots of variables. We're not always exactly certain what's going to happen on the day. In that way, I think if you're preparing for a film shoot, it's always about the level of control that you have. But with the specific life approach, you don't have the control that you'd ideally want. So you have to keep everything open. You have to be nimble on the day and be able to make changes and respond. And most of the time we're working with our performers for the very first time on the day that we're actually shooting their scenes. So we keep the dialogue, the scenes open so that we can do a lot of working out in the day.
So the
big main, obviously all the locations are in place. We know what shots we're doing. They don't change, but literally how it works in the day, it does change a lot.
Well, I think it's very interesting that you come from a theatrical background, because looking at your films, they're some of the most beautifully shot British films that are around at the moment, which to an observer who didn't know your background might think that you came from a background of photography or painting, like, say, someone like Derek Jarman or Peter Greenaway.
Yeah, and we would say that the theatrical background is very important in terms of an approach to kind of like staging the event, or some kind of, or acknowledging and recognizing the event around the filmmaking, and trying to stage the shoot in a way that I mean, with the civic life films, the camera plays a really important role. It's very foregrounded, the place of the camera and how it works in each of the civic life films, and I think Helen is no exception. And we've always driven in civic life films to make that a very strong element. Now, of course, when you throw into the mix with a feature-length film, the whole necessity to engage with narrative in a much more committed way, the civic life method almost works against that, and it's more of a struggle to deal with that, because you're not able to use a lot of the techniques and strategies that filmmakers would normally use to make narrative really work. So, you know, that's where the struggle would be. Our desire to really work with the camera to create a very cinematic, open, fluid piece of work that engages with the time and space of cinema would be very important at the forefront of how we'd approach civic life film. And then, as I said, of course, there's the other really crucial elements that you have to engage with when you're making a feature. There's no getting away from it. That was a much tougher challenge, trying to develop, extend that idea over a feature-length film.
But certainly, I mean, what I was getting at is that the aesthetics of your film seem to be something that's been missing from British cinema for years, just an actual joy in presenting beautiful images to the audience.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of film in the UK, I don't know, it's very plot-driven, very narrative-driven, and there's a resistance, a reluctance to hang out and to allow time to unfold in another way, to allow the dynamics of the film to exist in a different way, because everything's kind of pushed, and, you know, issues around story beats, you know, plot reveals, and those different kind of elements drive films, and there certainly isn't a history of filmmaking in the UK, at least recently, where people might have a different kind of strategy and approach to what it is that they want to do or what they want to see on the screen. Sometimes you could say that there's less of a willingness to engage with cinema, and always the dealing with drama and narrative is more foregrounded than plot, and that's not what the civic life films have been about at all. I mean, there's there is a few exceptions in the last year or two. If you look at the work of Andrea Arnold, and although her films are very kind of rooted in a social realism, they're also very cinematic, I think. And, you know, Red Road, there was a real desire as well to hang out and not to be in any big rush. And, you know, Dwayne Hopkins and Better Things and Joanna Hogg. And then, of course, Lynn Ramsey as a Morven Teller, I think, is a very interesting film. And again, a real approach to cinema that isn't always present. And so I think that there's certainly a recent body of work that's out there. Whether it's something that's gathering momentum and will have legs and hang around for a while, I don't know. But you know, we're very happy to be part of that kind of inquiry in UK cinema at the moment. You know, we're kind of really excited and, you know, just completely thrilled to be getting a release, of course.
Yeah.
On the other level, we're kind of totally wound up and anxious and thinking, oh my God, it's so kind of ruthless and difficult to find an audience. And, you know, our distributors don't have much money, so, you know, there's no big publicity campaign. Mm. We're very much dependent on, I don't know, word of mouth, reviews and that kind of stuff. And that's always going to be difficult with a film like Helen because it's quite divisive, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, the kind of reviews that it might receive. So, I don't know. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's certainly not. I don't think it's such an easy time to be putting out more kind of challenging art house films, you know, in the UK. It's a tough kind of distribution network that exists. Pretty ruthless.
Cool.
Okay, brilliant.
Right. Talk to you again soon.
You can find out more info about both O Horton, which is released on the 8th of May, and Helen, which was released in the cinema on the 1st of May, on our blog, www.electricsheepmagazine.wordpress.com. Thanks for listening.